Genetic engineering means different things, gene therapy, other aspects of manipulating, taking apart and putting back together genes, therapeutic purposes, economic purposes, eugenics, all kinds of reasons, some better and more appealing than others. Pretty recent development, last several decades basically, as we'll discuss in detail soon, kind of the historical development of the halachic and Torah literature. We have our first discussions of this in 1981 or so. It's, you know, fair to say, and that was a reaction to some of the earliest, of the very earliest of the modern efforts in this area, about 3-4 decades old. We have to discuss from a Torah perspective. We can talk about halacha, formal Jewish law. We can talk about hashkafa, Torah's outlook, theology, so to speak, medical ethics, Jewish medical ethics. We have to discuss both these questions about, you know, how do the formal prohibitions of the Torah, formal rules of the Torah apply, and the broader and more abstract question, is this in the spirit of the Torah? Is this God's will for the, you know, for his world or not? Broadly speaking, we have to discuss two questions. We have to discuss, is doing this initially, is this something we should be doing or not? That's the sort of question that's commonly discussed by secular non-Jewish bioethicists also. And then there is the ex post facto question, if it's been done, if you're allowed to do it, if it has been done, what are the consequences of doing this? How would halacha apply to the products of such techniques? So these range from the relatively minor, such as if you if you have a tomato that grows on a tree, due to doing funky stuff with its DNA, do you make the bracha that you make on fruits or on vegetables? Do you make ha'etz on this tomato, or do you make bari pri ha'adama, fruit of the ground? To the somewhat more serious, if you put genes from one animal into another, or genes from an animal into a plant, what is the kosher status of the resulting product? And to the really serious, to the literally questions of life and death, curing diseases via different types of gene therapy, fertility questions, and so on. So questions again, are you allowed to do this? And if you do it, who's the parent of the child born by messing with the genetic material, and so on? So we'll discuss a little bit of a survey of some of the, again, both halachic, both formal law, as well as, you know, theological, ethical material. Do kind of a survey of what has been said, what has been written on the topic for the last 30 or 40 years or so. The literature, as I said, begins with a paper, I think, in 1981 or so by a Rabbi Moshe Hirschler. He was responding to some rather controversial experiments that were done, experimental therapies that were done in 1980. A couple of doctors, a couple of medical researchers, Klein and Mercola, I think, Mercola. This was with regard to a disease called phesalamia. I'm not sure I'm pronouncing that right, but it's a disease.
Thalassemia.
I'm sorry, thank you. Thalassemia, it is a disease by which that affects the blood, that the cells are not, the blood cells are improperly constructed. They're not producing hemoglobin, which you need for your circulation. Prognosis is pretty bad. You can do blood transfusions and other therapies, but they don't work well long term, and the prognosis is pretty grim. So as a Hail Mary, so to speak, again, the Catholics are going to have their own views on all this stuff, and we'll turn to the Catholics and what they think of such techniques later, but as a Hail Mary, these doctors developed a technique by which, pretty crude by modern standards, but they developed a technique by which they would try to modify the genes, they would try to correct the genes to make them normal genes, but by which the cells would be able to produce hemoglobin and make the people live. There was an outcry. They were censured by the NIH for this kind of cowboy attitude of doing crazy experimental things on human beings, and I think they were forced to stop before they can get conclusive results. But if you look around, you can still find papers discussing the promise and potential of gene therapy for this type of disease. The diseases that are what they call single mutation diseases, which are caused by one concrete mutation in the DNA, are the most attractive targets because you're not dealing with whole complex reprogramming the whole body. You just have to replace one incorrect transcription with one correct transcription. That obviously is the kind of the low-hanging fruit, the easiest thing we can do, and the literature goes on from there. Handful of papers written over the years, some of them by the usual suspects, the great Orthodox Jewish bioethicist, Dr. Fred Rosner, Rabbi J. David Bleich, Rabbi Dr. Avram Steinberg, Rabbi Dr. Avram Sofer Abraham, some other people, specialists, Rabbi Moshe Tendler, a fellow named Loik, and so on. So just to give a little bit of a brief introduction to of what we're talking about. What is this gene therapy? What are we doing exactly? I'm not a scientist, but just to go through a basic, you know, layman's explanation, as far as I understand it, of what we're doing here. Some of these papers call on rabbis who want to actually issue rulings in this area, want to engage this stuff seriously, really need to know the science, have to consult scientists. Obviously, if we were doing this to issue serious rulings, we'd have to get into the science more deeply. But roughly speaking, we learned this in high school biology, for those of us who have been to high school in the last 50 years or so. So post Watson and Crick, we know that the central component of the cells is the nucleus. The nucleus typically has the DNA, deoxyribonucleic acid, not really important. It's basically it's a trite analogy, but the analogy is to software programming, to computer code that contains literally in a coded form instructions for what the body, what the individual cells are supposed to do. There are millions of these base pairs. There are only four characters in this code, A, C, G, and T. They go in pairs, they match to each other, and by the repeated entries, long, long strands of, you know, millions and millions of these things, they form a code. Individual base pairs make genes, many genes are in chromosomes. It's just an elaborate code that tells the cellular machinery what to do, what proteins to make, what to start making stuff, stop making stuff. Elaborate, you know, brilliant system for basically issuing instructions, for biological instructions, telling the cells and thereby the macroscopic structures in the body, telling them what to do. There are errors in the code. Occasionally things go wrong. There are mutations. They can, you know, they can happen. They can be congenital. They can be, DNA can be deformed through radiation while somebody's, while an organism is living, and then you have errors in the code that can lead to problems, typically, sometimes minor, and sometimes death as the result. And embryos, if there are mutations, they won't live very often. If they do live, they can suffer severe dysfunction. Adults, you can have all kinds of terrible problems. So that's one reason. One reason you want to play with the genes, one reason you want to correct them or reprogram them, is you want to solve problems. You want to save lives. You want to solve other crippling problems or even lesser problems. Fertility. Some fertility problems can be caused by problems with genetic machinery. And again, you know, the hope is by reprogramming them sometimes, you can solve problems. Now, there's a whole other area involving genetics, which is simply the question of diagnostics. You want to see if people are carriers of a disease. You want to see what the problem might be. That's really a different issue. That's a much less controversial area, certainly from a halakhic perspective. Simply examining to learn about, to understand better what's going on, that's not really what we're going to focus on today. We're going to focus on active genetics, as I said, reprogramming, correcting mistakes to solve problems. So the first thing you want to do is save lives, you know, aid in fertility. That's where the need and the desire to do this is most pressing. Then on the other end of the scale, you know, the stuff of futurists and science fiction writing is basically eugenics. People say, I would like my child to be 6'3" and have blue eyes and blonde hair and be a track star and be accepted into all the Ivy League schools of his choice. So, or to be a great Talmud Chacham, I guess, and to be a Yorei Shamayim. You can probably program some of that genetically too. Everyone has Bechira, but you can have tendencies toward good behavior or otherwise. You simply want to improve humanity. You want to, give God a hand, so to speak, and make humans or other objects or other biological organisms better and, you know, new and improved, better than they otherwise would be. In between, we have what the bulk of the work is probably today, is simply in agriculture and livestock farming. You want to improve things. You want to take a gene. Ray Black has all kinds of charming examples in his paper on the subject. You want to take genes that salmon uses to avoid freezing when it gets really cold in the water. You want to take those genes and put them in strawberries so you can have frost-resistant strawberries. Some of them are for drugs. Even if you're not going to reprogram humans, insulin apparently is commonly made by programming cells to bacteria and little cells in the lab to produce insulin. Other types of drugs that we do, they want to make certain produce resistant to bugs, to parasites, or alternatively, you want to make them resistant to the pesticides so you can slather on the pesticides and then kill the bugs. So for agribusiness, and then there are much more kind of altruistic and much more useful things, not just meant to benefit the bottom line. You want to make golden rice. You want to make rice that has more protein or more vitamins that people are not getting enough of in their diet. You want to simply improve the world around us. Improve. You know, God gave us all kinds of species, lots and lots of them. less of them now than they used to be, but you want to improve them. You want to crossbreed them. Well, crossbreeding, of course, has been done for millenniums. People have crossbred, but they did that the old-fashioned way. And now we have new techniques. We want to just cut out genes, kind of copy and paste them, cut them out, stick them in, and so on. We want to make new, frankenfoods if you don't like them. You want to make them, genetically modified organisms, to use the neutral term. You want to just improve them by giving them better nutrient profiles and so on. So what is the Torah's attitude with regard to all these things? So it's interesting. There's nothing really black and white. There's nothing that we can take directly from Torah literature and apply directly, clearly, unambiguously to these types of situations. Obviously, these techniques are quite new, the last several decades. You're not going to find anything in the literature directly on point. So the goal here of those who have written on the topic, those who have studied the topic, is to try to find values or try to find precedents, again, either in formal halachic law or in midrash or in Jewish theology and so on, try to find values or analogies that would shed some light on whether God thinks this is a good idea for humans to do this or not. And as I always point out in these contexts, this is an area where the Weltanschauung, where the outlook on the world of the person studying this will very much affect how he concludes, even if he's quoting Torah sources, which sources he emphasizes, which sources he downplays or reinterprets. Very much you get the impression that the way people look at the world will affect how they interpret the various literature of Chazal, rabbinic literature, and later literature on the topic. Just to quote some of the primary sources that are frequently invoked in this discussion, again, discussing... Yes. Rai Winter is mentioning that Kilayim is probably the first and foremost of the precedents. Kilayim is the name of a family of biblical prohibitions. Kilayim literally means mixture, problematic mixture, forbidden mixture. There are three or four different biblical prohibitions against Kilayim. The one that many of us are probably most familiar with is shatnez, which means garments that have wool and linen combined in certain ways. That's a forbidden mixture. That's specific to clothing. It's specific to wool and linen. As Rabbi Black points out, synthetic fibers, all kinds of made-up new fibers are fine. It's a specific prohibition against those two ingredients, wool and linen, in the same garment combined in certain ways. That is one form of kilayim shatnez. Beged kilayim shatnez, a garment of kilayim hyphen shatnez, you are not allowed to wear. There is kilei behema, which means crossbreeding animals, again, the old-fashioned way, by mating animals of different species. You're not allowed to do that. That's a biblical prohibition again. There is, the other two deal with agriculture, kilei zroim, kilei akerim. You're not allowed to plant different species together. You're not allowed to graft species in certain ways. There are different prohibitions involved in making crossbreeds between two different agricultural species, particularly with regard to vineyards and wheat. But in general, for our purposes, you're not allowed to combine different types of botanical species to make new ones. So, when we discuss different types of genetic engineering, we have to discuss both the abstract philosophical question, the theological question: does Kilayim tell us anything about God's plan, God's vision for the world that should give us a value that should inform us about the desirability of genetic engineering? And more technically, are we actually violating the law of Kilayim by, let's say, taking genes from a salmon and putting it into a strawberry, taking genes from a turkey or from an eel and putting it into a turkey, and so on? So that's what we have to discuss. So turning first to the theology. So the comments of Ramban, Nachmanides, one of the great theologians, one of the great thinkers within Judaism, medieval period, are often cited here. Nachmanides explains that God was opposed to Kilayim. God did not want these mixtures. He says God made every species for a reason. Every species has a point, or to use a fancier word, Rabbi Bleich likes the word telos, the Greek telos, a purpose and a goal and a point for which something was created. And the Ramban says, by mixing species and making new ones, you are saying that you have your own purposes, you're not respecting God's purpose, you're not respecting what God has done, you think that God made the world with this group of species, you want different species, you are essentially trying to, it's hubris, you have too much confidence, too much faith in that you know what you're doing, and not enough respect for God's plan, and therefore Kilayim is a problem, and many other of the followers of the Ramban, Rabbeinu Bachya, and then down in, Reb Leich points out, that down in the more recent era, the 19th century, Rav Hirsch, Rav Samson Raphael Hirsch, who was not, you know, the Ramban was a great mystic and often expresses ideas that are rooted in the mystical tradition. Rav Hirsch was decidedly not, to the extent that he did study mysticism, he interpreted it much more metaphorically. Nevertheless, Rav Hirsch takes a pretty hard line here. Rav Hirsch goes much further than that and says, not just Kilayim, but that we have the idea of Chukim in the Torah. The Torah has its laws that are divided into several broad categories. Mishpatim are kind of civil law, the laws that govern civil society. Those we typically understand, they're typically rational, they're typically, by rational I mean accessible to human reason. Then we have the ritual mitzvahs, many of which, again, have pretty transparent purposes. We eat matzah on Pesach to remember the Exodus. We keep Shabbos to remember God's creation of the world, and so on. But then we have the category of chukim, which the word Rabbi Bleich likes for them is irrational. They're not irrational, they're irrational. They are independent of reason, they're not accessible to reason, not analyzable by reason. So there's a lot of theology about what exactly the purpose of chukim is. Rav Hirsch's position is that chukim are, again, God has a telos in the world, a purpose. We typically don't understand it. That's what chukim are about. He has his unfathomable, inscrutable purposes in the world. These are embodied in the chukim, and Shatnez in particular, and therefore we should not be messing around and trying to flout God's designs for the world. Now, there are a number of issues, a number of counter-arguments to this idea that man should not try to play God, as is indicated by God's prohibition of Kilayim. Rabbi Abraham, one of the leading rabbinic medical ethicists of our generation, he actually takes a somewhat skeptical position to not genetic engineering per se. The comments I'm going to quote now are actually taken from his discussions of cloning, particularly human cloning, which he abhors, which he's appalled by. But in the course of his discussion, he begins with this Ramban. He discusses this Ramban, who says that it's inappropriate to try to mess around with God's species and make new species and make new kinds of creations that God never made. He points out that another one of Judaism's leading theologians, the Maral of Prague, Rabbi Yehuda Lowy of Prague, the Maral was not happy with this Ramban. The Maral says the Ramban is theologically mistaken. The Ramban's whole attitude is wrong. He says, he quotes a very famous Midrash. The Midrash says that Turnus Rufus, a Roman leader, in this case a theological troublemaker, he approached Rabbi Akiva, one of the great sages of the Mishnah, and he asked him, whose works are more beautiful? Whose works are better, so to speak, God's or man's? So he was, the lawyers have a rule, never ask a question on cross unless you already know what the answer is supposed to be. In this case, he expected the answer to be God's, and then he was going to ask him, so who do you think you are performing circumcision? God made a man with a foreskin, and what do you think you're doing trying to improve on God's handiwork? Rabbi Akiva saw where this was going. Rabbi Akiva was sharp, so Rabbi Akiva said, actually, man's handiwork is better. Turnus Rufus was thrown off his rhythm here. He asked him, man, look at the sky, look at God's creation. Today we see vastly more of it. Look at God's world. What could be more beautiful and more perfect, more brilliant than God's world? So Rabbi Akiva brought him some nice cakes and bagels and stuff, and he brought him some wheat, and he said, which is better? What would you rather eat for dinner tonight, stalks of wheat or a Danish? So the point was that, yes, God, the point was that, as Midrashim go, this is a pretty easily understandable one. Yes, God makes wheat, God makes the natural world, the natural world is beautiful, the natural world is brilliant. However, God also makes humans. The Torah says, Milu es aretz v'kivshuha. God charged Adam, the first man, with dominion over the world, with authority, and the need to conquer the world. Conquer not in the sense of oppress, but conquer in the sense of control, master, develop, create. So man is charged with improving the world. So man gets wheat and he makes it into bread, which is an improvement. So too, Rabbi Akiva was saying, yes, God made us with an arla, God created us uncircumcised, but he charged us with improving on this by the mitzvah of Mila. Says the Maral, he refers to this briefly, and he says the correct Jewish theology in his view is that, yes, God made a world, but that is not to say that we are stuck and we are limited to leaving the world as it is. It's our right, it's our duty, it's our privilege to improve on it. Anything we can do to improve is fine. You can't bring Kilayim as some kind of proof against this basic axiom, what he considers a basic axiom of Jewish theology. Rabbi Abraham himself sides with the Ramban. He says he doesn't understand the moral objection. Again, he's talking about cloning, about making, monsters and Frankensteins and stuff like that. He says you're allowed to improve on individual species, fix them up, cure disease maybe, but to make whole new species, to mix and match the genes, to create Frankensteins, that's different. you can debate where the line should be, but the point is we do have, it's important to note that although virtually all serious theological discussion within Judaism of genetic engineering discusses this Ramban, it's important to note, it's not always acknowledged, but the Maral disagreed with the Ramban. The Maral took the other side and felt that it's our right to improve on creation to the extent that we can. Yes?
What was Rav Hirsch objecting to?
Rav Hirsch is not discussing any actual case. He's just expressing general theology, general analysis of the Torah. I didn't see the quote inside. I saw Rav Black's excerpt of it, but it sounded like it was just a general theology. So that's the first question. What should our attitude be? You know, many people point out, again, Milua Saris Vikivshua, God is charged with creation, with the right to create, and others bring the Ramban. Rabbi Hirschler, who was one of the first, as I said, to discuss this question back in 1981, he was very, very skeptical about technology. I don't know if to make him into a complete alarmist, but he was, it's a very short paper, it's 3 or 4 pages. But his paper is full of a list of a parade of potential horribles. They're certainly genuine concerns. Thermonuclear war, artificial intelligence. He was writing this in 1981. It's back in the news lately. I just saw Stephen Hawking is calling for one world government to counter the possible threat of emergent AI. But artificial intelligence taking over the world and diseases creating superbugs and pandemics that are going to... not all these things are certainly genuinely worrisome things. I don't mean to downplay their threat, but it's a question of attitude. Should your attitude be, therefore, basically, turn off science, or should your attitude be, caution, or should your attitude be the more science, the better? I don't claim to have, any answers to this, but Rav Hirschler in this paper is taking a very, very concerned, very nervous, pessimistic view about how the dangers posed by unchecked, breakneck advances in science can easily outweigh the benefits they bring. He's skeptical about all these technologies, and when it comes to genetic engineering, again, he focuses on the Ramban. He's not writing Psak Halacha, he's not coming to issue a formal ruling, but from a theological, hashkafic perspective, he is very skeptical. And again, many people have pushed back and said, Dr. Rosner and others have said, it's the Ramban is a kind of equivocal source, and that not everything is going to lead to the extinction of humanity. Again, the problem is once you start, it's hard to stop, but the Pandora's box is open anyway. So obviously, these are, my point is, you can kind of argue one side or the other till the cows come home. The point is, Rabbi Hirschler takes a very skeptical view. Other Jewish theologians have taken more moderate or more somewhat more optimistic views. Regarding the technical prohibition of Kelayim, if you introduce genes from one species into another, are you actually violating the technical prohibition of Kelayim? So a number of leading Jewish thinkers, halachic thinkers, have argued that you are not. That is probably the consensus. Rav Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, one of the leading halachic experts of the last generation, the last century, argued that in general, it depends whether you are crossbreeding animals or botanical species, flora or fauna. He says, when it comes to animals, he starts getting into pretty technical arguments, but he says, when it comes to animals, the prohibition on crossbreeding actually involves two living animals and mating them together. Simply introducing genes from one to the other is not actually a problem. So he says, when it comes to introducing genes, like this case recently from the moray, that some eel into a chicken, I think, or a turkey, that would be fine, he would say. He felt that when it comes to mixing plants together, that's more of a problem. Technical considerations, not anything, not a philosophical argument. He argues the way the Torah wrote and constructed the prohibitions on Kelayim of botanical species, as long as you have at the end of the day a mixture of two species growing in the field, that's a problem. So he felt that might be more of a problem. So actually, transplanting genes from one type of flora to another might actually be a problem, according to him, and others disagree. One of the, again, from working within the technical area now, one of the arguments often proposed why it would not be a problem, and this affects questions like the kashrus status of the resulting organism too, is a very interesting halachic point. There is a long tradition going back to the 19th, maybe 18th century even, there's a long tradition within halacha, within formal Jewish law, that if you can't see it, it doesn't count. Things that you don't see with the naked eye doesn't count. As Jews, we are not allowed to eat bugs. We're not allowed to ingest bugs. But again, microorganisms, organisms that are not visible to the naked eye, are fine. I mean, everything we eat is covered with the Dutch fellow, Leeuwenhoek, the fellow who discovered the first microscope, who devised good lenses. One of the first things he saw was everything he looked at was crawling with microorganisms. And we eat them, we ingest them, and that's the way things go. And our gut needs all these things to digest food properly and so on. So everyone agrees that Torah has no prohibition against ingesting microorganisms. And the reason commonly given is, even though theoretically you blow them up big enough, they look pretty buggy, but it doesn't matter. The point is that if you can't see them with the naked eye, they do not count. There's been a lot of controversy in recent years about different types of bugs, copepods in New York water and other things. The issue there is always that the bugs are somewhat visible to the naked eye, not like, ew, there's a giant cockroach in the water, but if you look closely, you see a speck, and it's moving and swimming. The question is, how visible does it have to be to the naked eye? What do you see? How carefully do you have to look? That's where all the debate is. But in principle, everyone agrees, if they are literally not visible to anyone without a microscope, they do not count. There are similar halachas in many areas of the Torah.
Where would you get the distinction between flora and fauna based on the key lion prohibition? It seems like there's no distinction. It's like you can't.
Well, the distinction derives from the fact that there are several different biblical verses that prohibit different forms of kelayim. They're listed as, among the 613 mitzvahs, they're listed separately. One of them is behemtechelo sarbia kelayim. The word sarbia means to mate or to, so that implies physically combining two animals in a sexual union to make a new animal. When it discusses botanical kelayim, the language is sadechelo sizra kelayim. Do not plant your field kelayim. The language is kind of more abstract and more general. It's a debatable distinction, and it's kind of technical, so I don't want to get too deeply into it, but it has to do with just the way the verses are written. It's not based on some kind of scientific or it's not based on any kind of objective scientific concern. We don't know why God said it, though, but it's based on just the biblical language. So there are other halachas about this invisible thing. The halacha is letters in a Sefer Torah. Certain parts of letters are supposed to touch each other. Certain parts are not supposed to touch. For example, the hay, the leg of a hay, not supposed to touch the roof of the hay, but the different strokes on a bays are all supposed to be connected. So sometimes you have cases where something that's not supposed to touch does, or something that is supposed to touch doesn't. The question is, how carefully do you look? And again, many poskim have said, not everyone agrees, but many poskim have said, you don't need to use microscopes. You look at visible to the naked eye. Whatever is invisible to the naked eye does not count. And this is a well-regarded principle, a well-established principle, halacha generally agreed on in many cases, if not all, that halacha only considers that which you can see. Therefore, many halachic authorities, many writers on this topic have argued genetic material is typically invisible. I mean, you use microscopes for it, and you detect it using indirect methods. You typically have to multiply it using techniques such as PCR to get millions of copies of it. An individual piece of DNA is not visible, you can't see, certainly not to the naked eye. Therefore, they've argued, if you take, for example, a bit of genetic material from a non-kosher animal, and you put it into the DNA of another animal, a kosher animal, that will have no effect on the kosher status of the kosher animal, because what you don't see doesn't count, basically, and therefore it doesn't matter from a halakha perspective. Now, again, this is not some kind of anti-science denying it exists. We know it exists. We work with it. But it doesn't matter. Halakha, as law sometimes does, has to work with standards that are accessible to humans. The fact that we can devise machines and techniques and clever and brilliant techniques for inferring their existence or manipulating them doesn't mean that this is a problem.
Now, can one argue that this whole principle is based on the fact that it's insignificant if it can't be seen? In contrast, genetics, I mean, genes that are so prominent and important.
Yes, so I was going to get to that point in a moment.
Nobody would say you could put arsenic in your friend's drink.
Right.
It's not seen.
So I'm going to discuss that. That's the next thing I want to discuss.
What about the fact that at the end of the day, this animal has split hooves and chews its cud?
Right. Another issue. So several points being raised here. The fact that this is not just incidental and significant. This is millions and billions of dollars going into devising the technology, and you're working with it for hours in the lab, and you know it's there, and you made it come there. So A, the first step is, right, you deliberately made it there. Your entire career is based on working with these things. You can hardly argue that they're just insignificant, out of sight, out of mind. That's completely inconsistent with your whole laboratory here. B, as Ray Winter mentioned, consequences are discernible. The outcomes are very clear. A lot of things that are too small, the bugs, you don't notice them. You don't see them. They have no effect. The hair, the whole point is to change a biological trait in the target organism. And C, get to that a little bit later, about the changing the simanei kasher, it's changing the kosher signs. So the first two arguments that Rabbi Winter raised were actually, those were actually raised by two of the leading halachists, again, of our generation, of the last generation, Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach again, and Rav Yehoshua Neuwirth, or Neubert, the author of the Shmiras Shabbos Kol Chasa, another leading, I think that was his work, another leading halachist. They made these two points. Rav Auerbach argued that if incidentally there's a microscopic bug in your lettuce, if it's literally invisible, it doesn't count. But if you put it there, if you worked with it, if that was your whole point and that's the whole goal of your exercise, you can't then claim and turn around and say it doesn't count. Similarly, the idea of consequences, Rav Neubert said that if there are major consequences, the whole point of this exercise, after all, is to have some major macroscopic accomplishment, then again, you cannot apply that argument. So again, these were people that Rabbi Abraham consulted with, and they both said, and they both published, I think, elsewhere, that these arguments do not apply in such cases where you deliberately engineered, literally engineered, the whole thing to use these substances. There is just a minor digression here. There is, among some of the most far out and strangest application of this principle that what we don't know doesn't count in halacha, there is a responsum, a ruling of Rabbi Shlomo Avinair, a leading Israeli halachist, contemporary Israeli halachist. He was discussing not genetic engineering, he was discussing the use of DNA forensics to identify a cadaver, to identify a missing man, to identify him with a cadaver to allow his widow to remarry. There's a lot of literature on this, particularly post-September 11th, identifying remains of bodies that are otherwise not identifiable. In general, poskim are willing to do this. The leading halakhic authorities have been willing, especially in the context of aguna, especially for the great need of allowing a woman to remarry, they have been willing to be lenient, to rely wholly, or at least significantly, on DNA evidence to identify remains. Rav Avinair was discussing a somewhat different question. He was not discussing allowing a woman to remarry, where there's a great halakhic pressure, halakhic impetus to find a leniency. He was discussing the opposite kind of case. There was a question of bastardy, of mamzerus. There was a child who had been identified potentially as not being born from the husband and therefore having severe halachic restrictions, marital restrictions. And again, here the halachic impetus is to try to avoid having to assign the status. We try very hard to find halachic arguments to avoid having to cripple somebody's life like this. So in this case, the DNA was the DNA fingerprinting, everyone has it pretty, even though we all share the traits that make us human, and we even share, they say, I think 99.something% with chimpanzees or whatever, but the fact is we all have unique DNA signatures, a one with many, many zeros, 12 zeros, more zeros. If you do it properly, you can distinguish between people with overwhelming degrees of accuracy, used in criminal cases, and in halacha it can be used to either to identify somebody, as in the aguna cases, or it can be used to confirm or to refute parentage. In Rav Avinair's case, people wanted to use DNA to affirm that somebody was a mamzer, which would be a devastating personal status for him. Rav Avinair said no, ignore the DNA, and one of his primary arguments was DNA is microscopic, what you can't see doesn't count, and therefore we ignore the evidence. This is, I think, very much an outlier. This runs against, I think, the mainstream trend of Jewish thought. Certainly here we have the arguments that Rabbi Winter and others raised before. Here, you're not dealing with a bug which is microscopic. You're dealing with a great macroscopic question. Who is his father? Is it him or him? This is simply evidence. This is even a more extreme thing. This is simply evidence you're using to ascertain, are you the father or are you the father? To argue that the DNA doesn't count because it's too tiny is, I think, a problematic and not mainstream application of this type of logic.
You can't do the test, but you don't believe the results.
That's a good point. So there are poskim who say don't do the test. Rabbi Yashiv held this way. There are some poskim who say just don't do the test for other arguments. Not our job to test. We have no obligation to perform such tests. And we'll discuss another opinion on that line soon. He seemed to say, though, even if the test was done, you can discard the results, which is a radical position. The idea of not doing the test first appears in one of the strangest and funniest responses I ever saw on halacha by an authority of about a century ago called Rabbi Aaron Levin. He was asked about a case. It was a very, very bread and butter, down to earth kashrus question. Someone had received a brace of fowl. I think one was a goose and one was a chicken. They had been sent by mail. They had shipped them with dry ice or just what they did from a town at some distance. It was a kashrus shayla, and one of the birds had a shayla, and the question was, did it affect the other bird? It depends how they were prepared. Were they salted together or not? So Rabbi Levin wanted to be lenient based on the argument that it's a suffix, a case of doubt, we don't really know, and there's basis for leniency. He says, wait a second. But there is a halakhic obligation, he says, if we can resolve doubt, we have an obligation to do so. He says, this is about 1930, he says, so today they have developed a machine called a telephone, which means that you go to the post office and you pay them money and you can talk to somebody in another town far away. So you can do that. You can go to the post office and make a phone call and find out the details that you don't know and maybe eliminate the doubt. You don't have to do that, he says. First of all, he says, the rule is you only have to try to resolve doubt if it is convenient and inexpensive. Going down to the post office and paying money to use a telephone is neither convenient nor inexpensive. Fine. I mean, that's just a factual question. It probably wasn't in somewhere in Eastern Europe in 1930. I have no doubt that it was not particularly convenient or cheap. Yes, and I don't know, yes. And B, and this is the really interesting argument, he says, halacha works with normal human civilization and culture. Halacha only takes into account things which are normal. If people have kunsten, people have inventions and brilliant ideas and new ways of doing things, halacha doesn't care. Halacha simply follows the old-fashioned way of doing things. I very much doubt he would say this today where there are virtually more cell phones than people on the planet. There are some several billion phones on the planet, and everyone has a computer that was in their pocket that was more powerful than the ones my father worked on for IBM in the late 60s, early 70s, and so on. So at some point, I think you probably have to say they've gone from being a brilliant, and they're still brilliant, but the point is they just become such a part of the fabric of daily living that you no longer consider them something unusual and strange and interesting. But nevertheless, his point was you don't have to make the call. He does not say he acknowledges if you make the call, you accept the results of the phone call, but he just says you don't have to make the call. But nevertheless, getting back to our point, there is some thinkers who have argued that we don't take into account DNA because it's tiny and it's not visible to the naked eye. Others have argued, based on the arguments we discussed earlier, that if that's the whole point of your exercise and the consequences are significant and easily visible on a macroscopic level, these arguments do not apply. So that's a matter of considerable debate. Regarding the question of the split hooves and the scales on the fish, if you can get a pig to have for animals, we know that there are two simanim that render an animal kosher, two signs. One of them is having split hooves, the other one is chewing its cud, ruminant stomachs, as in cows and sheep. If you can engineer a pig to have, the pig has one, it doesn't have the other, the pig has the split hooves, it doesn't have the ruminant stomachs. If you could engineer a non-kosher animal that had the proper simanim, that's something that's discussed at length, mostly speculative. They haven't actually done this in a practical way, but that's something discussed. It's a topic which is somewhat beyond the scope of our talk. A lot of technical, the Talmud already has all kinds of bizarre cases about what happens when one species gives birth to another species. Do we follow the parent species? Do we follow the child? Do we look at genotype and phenotype and so on? So this is a topic that takes us a little bit beyond the scope of our talk, but just note briefly that this is discussed by thinkers, although it's mostly been a theoretical exercise rather than a practical one. So returning to gene therapy for the purpose of healing humans, we find in general most of the stuff is still hasn't reached widespread usage yet. Mostly it's still experimental, it's still trials, it's still very much theoretical. To the extent that the post-com have discussed it, the general attitude is that there's no real precedent in halacha one way or another. The arguments from God's vision for the world, very much speculative. One important theological point, philosophical point that is frequently invoked is the idea expressed most eloquently, apparently, by Rabbi Yisrael Lifshitz, a leading 19th century Victorian, so to speak, German Victorian thinker. He says, the rule of the Torah is, by default, everything is permitted until you have a reason to prohibit it. We don't need permission to do stuff. It's not that we need permission to do anything. We have to find a source for allowing it. The default is, do whatever you want, unless God has prohibited it. If you have something new and interesting sounding and a little out there, we don't have to look for a reason to permit it. We have to look for a reason to prohibit it. If you don't have a reason to forbid it, then by default it's mutter. It's permitted. So many authorities have argued that if you don't have an actual reason for prohibiting it, the fact that it sounds a little funny to you, that is not a reason. Unless you can make a close and carefully reasoned argument for why it should be prohibited, then it is not going to be usher. I have a story I like to tell. A friend of mine His father was a pioneer in special education in the Jewish community, the Orthodox Jewish community, and he worked in the Hasidic cultures, which were often often very conservative, very slow to change, suspicious sometimes of newfangled things. So when my friend's father was campaigning, was trying to get, line up support for his innovative special education, he's a university educated fellow, and when he was trying to line up support for his ideas, they once went to a certain influential Hasidic personality. They showed him their prospectus, their proposal, and they asked him to lend his authority to their proposal. Apparently, there might have been some miscommunication here. So this Rebbe, he looks at it and he carefully studies it, and he looks at them pensively and he says, sounds better in Yiddish, but he says, "I'm not sure I have any basis for forbidding this." So he said, no, we want you to support this. Oh, you want me to support it? Okay. So yeah, the point is that the default position really has to be that something is mutter unless you have a good reason to prohibit it. So many have argued that unless you have a good reason to prohibit it, then it's going to be mutter. When it comes to these types of gene therapies, genetic engineering, there isn't really, assuming you get around the technical kalayim issues, there isn't really going to be any clear and obvious reason for forbidding it. Therefore, many thinkers, many writers on the topic, Dr. Rosner and others, have argued that the general imperatives, certainly if it involves saving human lives or significantly improving the quality of human lives, curing diseases, the general imperatives of rapa yirape, the Torah tells us that there is an imperative upon us to heal, upon the physician to heal, to save lives, is of paramount importance. The general clear imperatives to do good, balanced against kind of nebulous and uncertain arguments against, certainly if it involves saving lives, it will generally be a good thing to do and recommended. If it's just about making strawberries that don't freeze as often and either getting people tastier strawberries or helping the bottom lines of companies, here the imperative to do it is not going to be as strong. On the other hand, you still really need some kind of reason to prohibit it. So if we turn to non-Jewish bioethics, so certainly when it comes to doing stuff to humans, we find a whole array of concerns, some of which clearly are things that we would be concerned with too, some of which have little or no parallel in Jewish law. So for example, personal autonomy. Everyone agrees that you can't go around experimenting with someone else without his permission, but some secular bioethicists argue that what they call germline gene therapy, where you affect the cells that are going to pass along their traits to the next generation, the sperm and the egg, or the cells that involve reproduction, you're affecting the whole child when he develops from an embryo into an adult. If you're affecting, or if you do stuff to a child while he's little and he's not capable of expressing consent, we know that in our generation, the last several decades, secular ethics has raised personal autonomy into, almost fetishized it, raised it into a or the paramount concern. Now, there's no question we recognize in the Torah, too, that personal autonomy is a real thing, but we don't take it nearly as far as they do. They want to do things like prohibit circumcision because until the child reaches the age of consent, you can't mutilate him until he expresses his desire for or against. Obviously, we have a mitzvah of milah, and in general, we believe that parents can make decisions about for their children. Some hardliners will even say you can't vaccinate a kid because he's not old enough to, maybe he doesn't want to be vaccinated, you have to ask his permission. Again, we argue that the mainstream Jewish position is that the medical need to do it in most cases is great for the kid himself, for society, the downside is low, and that we don't kind of elevate personal autonomy into a religion, into a fundamental principle of faith, that it can never be tampered with under any circumstances. Certainly, if you're going to cure a serious genetic disease of a child, you don't have to wait till he grows up and you can ask him whether he's in favor. You can assume he's in favor. It's for his own good. If you just want to make him a little bit taller and make his nose straighter and make him a track star, maybe there'd be some concern about personal autonomy, although, again, it isn't really expressed as any real value in Judaism one way or another. So it's not something the Torah has that much to say about. One concern, which Rabbi Hirschler mentions and many others mention, and this certainly is something we're concerned about, is destroying the world. Obviously, unchecked, a lot of these technologies can lead, untrammeled, can lead to terrible things. So clearly, Halacha doesn't want humans to destroy the world. Adam himself was commanded, Hashem said, "I'm putting you here, you're in charge, you're in control. Hizaher shlo tashkes es olami. Be careful you don't destroy the world, whether by sin or by other ways of doing it." Obviously, it goes without saying that in Judaism, we are opposed to causing mass destruction of humans or even non-humans, but certainly humans. So clearly, if the bad outweighs the good, we shouldn't be doing it. But you don't need Jewish bioethics to tell you that particularly, and we don't have any It's hard to argue that there is a particularly Jewish version of this. Obviously, in Judaism, we place a paramount value on human good and certainly the saving of lives, and we might draw the balance somewhere differently. Some secular bioethicists might be more concerned with the sanctity of other species, or if not, they might say don't introduce non-native species, or don't alter the natural course of biological evolution. These might not be concerns that we share as much as they do. But again, this is largely an ethics question which doesn't have clear or direct roots within Judaism. The thing I think that's most fairest to say within the Jewish perspective is that Judaism does not have very strong views on most of these questions. Like with a lot of modern technology, that's what, like a lot of modern technology, we don't really have a strongly held view specific to the technology. Our attitude often is we weigh the good against the bad. If in experts' views the good significantly outweighs the bad, we will generally be in favor. And if the bad outweighs the good, we will not be in favor. How cautious should you be? How nervous should you be about unforeseen consequences? The worst nightmares of the science fiction writers versus the utopian hopes of some of the boosters is a good question, but not one that there is a clear answer within Judaism for. I do want to discuss one final point, which is, should we care in general, should we be influenced at all by what other cultures, whether it's secular bioethics or Catholic theology, should we care, should we be interested in their views on the subject? Should we try to develop everything completely internally from the Torah, or should we pay a decent respect for the opinions of mankind on these questions, defer to them? This question has come up a number of times in Jewish tradition. Perhaps most sharply, my favorite example occurred several decades ago with the advent of assisted reproductive technologies, ART, techniques such as in vitro fertilization, IVF. There was a ferocious debate among halachists, among Jewish halachic authorities, several decades ago. Particularly, the debate was about using, for a married woman, using sperm from a man, not her husband. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein was lenient, not happily and only in certain cases, but he was, in principle, willing to be lenient. Many other authorities, particularly the Hasidic authorities, were aghast, were completely appalled. They thought this was unthinkable, and there was a ferocious halachic battle over the question. One of the leading opponents of Rabbi Feinstein was Rabbi Yaakov Breisch, a leading Hasidic authority from Switzerland. He was furious with Rav Moshe Feinstein. One of his arguments was, which he develops at some length, he says, is the Catholic Church thinks this is an abomination. They're appalled by this. How can we as Jews not have moral standards at least as strict or at least as stringent as the Catholics? Rav Moshe wrote back to him, basically shrugged his shoulders and says, we're Jews. We have the Torah. The Torah tells us what to do, and frankly, I just don't care what Catholic theology says. Rav Breisch says, no, yes, you should care what Catholic theology says, and Rav Breisch tries to marshal sources within the Jewish tradition to argue that, yes, the Torah does expect us to have some deference to the moral standards of other cultures, at least not to be lenient, but at least to be stringent. It would be a chil Hashem, a desecration of God's name, if we ignored their scruples, or maybe other reasons. He argues at length that we should have some deference to their standards, while Rav Moshe simply says, nope, no such thing. On the contrary, we're commanded not to follow in the ordinances of the non-Jews, and we simply have to have our own standards. Now again, obviously there have to be, even someone like Rav Breisch, there have to be limits. If you really want to follow the Catholic Church, they're particularly upset about using genetic material from a donor. They're also very upset about using genetic material from the husband. They're upset about a lot of things. If you want to start, they're upset about divorce. Yes, thank you. They're upset about divorce. If you really want to adopt their standards of morality, you would have to restrict quite a lot of things, which we allow, tolerate, even encourage sometimes. So obviously there have to be limits. And the question is, where are those limits? I don't know. So when you want to start discussing things like gene therapy, I'm not an expert in Catholic theology. I took a quick look around at some of the Catholic statements on the topic, and they're not nearly as opposed to some of it as they are to assisted reproductive technology. They're cautiously tolerant of it if it can help humans. But in general, here the issue might be more some of the secular bioethicists. They're the ones, I think, who are leading the drive for moratoriums and for freezes until we understand things better. In general, they're the ones who are very squeamish, both for practical reasons as well as for a kind of general inchoate fear of what this could lead to, or of a kind of almost pantheistic respect for the natural world and its natural evolution on its own without human tampering with it. So here, the question is, should we have any deference per se to, even if we're going to argue, you don't have to follow every fringe or every radical thinker, if there is a general consensus among bioethicists that certain behavior is wrong, should we defer to that or not? It's an interesting question. Rabbi Feinstein might say no. I mean, obviously, you don't want to, fight them in public more than you have to, but we should make our decision based on Torah values. Again, following Rabbi Lifshitz, that if you don't have an argument, anything not prohibited is permitted. If you do have an argument, make the argument, and we don't particularly care what other bioethical traditions would say. On the other hand, Rabbi Reich and others have argued that we do need to have some respect, and it would be inappropriate for us to say that we're going to act like loose cannons, just do whatever we want, and despite the fact that serious people who have considered the matter carefully have argued that certain things are not appropriate. So I don't know. I haven't really seen any direct discussion of this point itself, whether and to what extent we should have any, we should allow our value system to be informed by theirs or not. That, I think, is an important question which hasn't really received any attention. Just to quote one or two other examples.
I mean, there's a distinction here because it's a more global issue, like introducing new organisms, something that could affect everybody.
More of a reason to respect them or not to respect them?
To have more of a consensus.
Right. So Rowan just pointing out, it's one thing to say what I do personally in my family is I can do it. Another thing to say I'm going to tamper with the whole biome and the whole biosphere. So yeah, you can make that argument too. As I mentioned before, just returning back to civil law for one moment, another one of my favorite examples of a case where halacha does, according to some opinions, take into account secular law is intellectual property. There's a celebrated ruling of Rabbi Yosef Shaul Nathanson, a leading Galician halachist of the 19th century, who argued halacha doesn't really have much in the way of intellectual property jurisprudence. He acknowledges. He says, however, right-thinking people, as well as general European law, takes for granted that an author has the right to control the dissemination and to profit from the dissemination of his works, his creative works. Therefore, he says, lo tehei Torah shleima shelanu k'sicha b'teila shelahem. If they have it, we have to have a similar value too. Again, there have to be limits to that, obviously, but the idea that we can infer what the halacha should say, especially if the halacha has no explicitly articulated view on the topic, the idea that halacha should look to what upright and decent and intelligent people think on a topic is not completely verboten, is not completely alien to Jewish tradition. How far to take it, especially when lives are at stake, if we feel we have a therapy that can save lives or that can help the childless and they want to forbid it on general bioethics rules, obviously that would be not so easy to do, but not necessarily totally wrong to defer or to inform ourselves somewhat by looking to what general secular bioethics has to say on the topic.